Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasani Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare.
Okay, so here this Nyaya Ratna, here's one Nyaya. Ratna means Nyaya. Nyaya is one of the schools of Vedic thought on based on the Vedas that takes logic as the supreme, as that is the process and the logical conclusion is the goal, and it's an impersonal path. And here then this Nyaya Ratna, they're also Shaktas, so then they apply this within the realm of worship of Durga, so then they are, you know, materialists. But here is their idea is that they've seen the Vaishnava religion in this area has been established from the time of Lord Chaitanya. And so then the Smarta religion was going before that. So then they're a little bewildered about the idea that Vaishnavism is eternal. So therefore these questions are there. Plus they're trying to establish naturally that the supremacy of Tantra and, you know, impersonal understanding over personal. So Nyaya Ratna is asking a question to Vaishnav Das here. Nyaya Ratna, does any Vedic passage affirm this idea that the worship of Krishna and not impersonal knowledge is the highest attainment? Vaishnav Das, in the Taittiriya Upanishad 2.7.1 it is said, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the reservoir of transcendental mellows. That's the Anandamaya. No, that's not Anandamaya. What's that? Raso Vai Saha. Raso Vai Saha. It means he is the you know, source of all rasas coming from him. In the Chagandogya Upanishad 8.13.1 it is said, to attain Lord Krishna, I surrender to Sri Radha. To attain Sri Radha, I surrender to Lord Krishna. I can quote many Vedic passages proving that devotional service to Lord Krishna is the highest attainment. So then here. So here is that Krishna is the ocean of rasa. All rasa comes from him. Everybody's looking for rasa. So then. But all that rasas come from him. So whatever there is of any taste anywhere, that's him. So even the taste of this Brahman realization is the impersonal knowledge is that taste is coming from him. You know, though it's tasted through the intelligence. But the mind is the one that has to taste. The mind tastes the senses. The mind is tasting other relationships, and so even the intellectual aspects, the mind is also tasting that. So taste is gotten through the mind, because what it accepts gives taste, what it rejects doesn't give taste, or it gives a negative taste. So therefore everything then has to be connected to Krishna. Whatever we find that has some taste to it is actually Krishna, but because of our conditioning we identify that it's not Krishna. We think it's something else, you know. Just like a very straightforward example would be like prasadam. Prasadam is Krishna, so the taste in it is Krishna. But we are tasting that taste of Krishna. Let me move forward. We are tasting that taste of Krishna, but the tendency will be is we'll say, you know, it's the taste of this spice and of this vegetable and these things. That aspect is there. But what makes prasad unique is not the spicing and all these things. What's unique is that Krishna's tasted it. That's what's special. So actually the attraction to prasad is Krishna. But we'll take it that it's a sabji we like, a spicing we like, you know, these kind of things. So the same thing applies even on the mundane. Is that everything is actually Krishna's entered it. The universal, the 7th, the 10th, and the 11th chapters of the Gita then explain how Krishna has entered all the different things of the world, all the opulences, all the the, you know, whatever is desired by the living entity. And then the living entity, being attracted by those things, thinks it is Krishna. I mean, thinks it is that thing. You know, like something something adventurous. Someone goes and does some activity, some sport, something that creates a spirit of adventure. So most will then figure that the adventure, what they're doing is what is giving them that taste. You know, they're, you know, like racing cars, or they're skydiving, or mountain climbing. They're doing some kind of extreme activity, and they're feeling that that is giving the taste, but it's not. It's because Krishna is adventure. Whatever it is, that taste will be there. Because one person will find one of them to be no taste, because for them it's not adventure. So whatever is adventure for you, then it will give the same taste, and that taste is Krishna. But you'll think it's the thing, because of our conditioning. So we'll identify the external of it. We won't see beyond that. So whatever we're attracted to is Krishna. Krishna is he is rasa. So whatever we're tasting, it's him. But we don't think it's him. As soon as we understand it's him, then but to understand that it's him means we have to give up our idea that we are this body, that we're doing the tasting. Right? Because it's the conditioned nature, which is not us, which is in contact with the other material energy. Material energy is contacting material energy. So, therefore, we're not actually part of the loop. We're completely out of it. But because we identify with it, therefore, then we get something out of it. Like watching a movie. It means the movie, it's people, it's nothing to do with us. But because we identify with them, identify with the hero or the other people like that, or identify with the activities that they are doing, then we get some taste from it. Like when the hero is happy, we're happy. When they're not, then we're not. And, you know, like this. Because we identify with it. But it's not us. It's nothing to do with us. So this would answer the doubt on, well, but if we're not involved in it, how is it that we're tasting something? It's by this. It's vicarious. Means taste in this material world is vicarious. Some of it is obviously vicarious, but actually the whole thing is vicarious. Because you have the soul, then they're connected to these things that aren't us. It's dead matter. Dead matter contacting dead matter. But because of our identity with it, then we then take it. We take mundane standards of good and bad according to our own choice. Then we decide this was good, so I'm happy. This is not good, I'm not happy. Well, the other person has exactly the opposite approach. Same matter. So therefore, it's a separate thing. So when that is understood, then you can see Krishna in everything. Because then your senses are just vehicles for understanding and seeing Krishna's potencies. Then the service comes as seeing Krishna in this way. So this is this aspect of jnana. Then jnana, the jnana yoga, this is how it's used. That the intelligence, the mind, the senses are used to understand the knowledge, to see the knowledge practically. So it has to be separated in that way. Karma yoga means that you're identifying with the senses and you're engaging those senses in the Lord's service. And so they're being engaged. So you identify, yes, I'm a manager, so I manage for Krishna, and now we're getting this result good for Krishna, or the result's not coming good for Krishna, we have to change our management technique to get a good result for Krishna. So then that's nishkam karma yoga. And then sakam is I have to adjust it because I'm not getting a good result. Right? Like that. Nishkam is Krishna's not getting a good result. And jnana yoga means you're doing the same thing, but you're watching the energy work. You're just watching, because you're not doing it. You want to take part, Krishna, the modes of nature are doing it. So then you can be amazed at how it's working. The other you think you're doing it, you know, but it's Krishna's. I'm doing it, but it's Krishna's. The result, I'm doing this for Krishna, I'm detached. Jnana yoga is I'm not doing it, I'm simply watching it. But I'm taking part, I'm doing what my duties, so therefore I'm taking part and watching it all, and it's amazing how it's happening. You know, like Arjuna, how is Arjuna defeating Bhishma, Drona, Kripa, all these people? Not possible. Bhishma is not ordinary, we just see him generally. Bhishma has mystic powers. He's not from here. He's from the heavenly planets. His mother is Ganga Devi. He's trained by Brihaspati. He's trained by Sukracharya. He's trained by Parasuram. So what he knows, he's way beyond anything that's on the earth. Way beyond. Like that. You know, he's not, means even what Arjuna knows, he's way beyond all that. He's in his own category. But because he's not taking up, he's doing the Kshatriya duties, so he does everything. But he does not need to prove himself because he's not a Grihastha. So he doesn't have to establish, he doesn't have those aspects of the Dharma to do. A Grihastha has certain ego, has to be maintained. Like that, women are attracted by opulence, so that opulence has to be maintained. Otherwise, one can't perform one's Grihastha duties properly, especially as a Kshatriya. I mean, Kshatriyas are powerful, so are Kshatriya women. So you have to be more powerful. Then the attraction is there, then it works nicely. He's not, he's a brahmachari. He doesn't have to worry about that. So though he has powers way beyond, he doesn't need to show them. He does, how much needs to be done, that's it. Because he's so high class, so self-controlled. He doesn't have to prove anything. So how Arjuna can defeat Bhishma is way beyond. It's not possible. Drona, how is it possible? Like that, it's not. There are things Drona knows he hasn't taught Arjuna. Like in putting armor, the most subtle way of putting armor, he's only taught to Abhimanyu. Because Abhimanyu is also, he's the son of Soma. You know? So therefore, he has that consciousness. It means normally they put the armor on tightly. You fix it in place. That way then it's on and you don't have to worry about it because you're so busy, you know, with your strategies and fighting. But Abhimanyu has learned the style where you leave it on loose. So there's big gaps between the armor. But you're so conscious of what's happening by shifting the body and moving, you sling things around. Then you can close any gap there is. Because the regular one, you always hear of when they fire the arrows, if they're expert, they can get it in between the cracks of the armor. You know, so you have that little tip of the arrow poking through. It's like, you know, needles poking. So then it's a great disturbance. But Abhimanyu doesn't have that problem. Because he'll just shift his weight, you know, shift his shoulder or something. That'll throw the armor to one side and it'll close the gap. So therefore, they can never poke anything in between. He knows this. Arjuna isn't. He doesn't have that same level of consciousness, you know, that Abhimanyu has. So Drona knows it. He's taught this to Abhimanyu. So what more he knows? Like that, he's been defeated by Arjuna. So I mean, how they will do this? This is because Krishna is doing it. So Arjuna has no problem with that. Therefore, he can function on that platform. He just watches it happen. He does his duty. What he knows, he does. Like that. But he just watches it happen. And so then, so this is the Madhyama platform, is that they go into this Nishkam Karma Yoga, they go into the realm of the Jnana Yoga. And so then they can watch from this. Then they can see rasa everywhere. Otherwise, the beginning level is that you see rasa in connection with your senses. Next is you see rasa in connection with the mind. Then next is you see that it's Krishna interacting, not us. Krishna is the material energy. Krishna is entered. That Krishna is doing all these things. And we're just watching it. It's Krishna's pastime. He's created it for the living entity out of his kindness. One has to be very careful is that one sees it in the mood of service. It's not that it's Krishna, and therefore, because it's Krishna, I can enjoy it. Oh, Krishna is the beauty of women, so therefore I can enjoy that beauty. No, because it's then you're exploiting Krishna, so it's unfavorable devotional service. Therefore, it can't be done. So, but you may it may be seen is that attraction that we have for anything, for wealth, for women, for followers, for anything, that is coming, it's Krishna's potency, it's Krishna that makes that attractive. But he is those, because he has those opulences. He is the Lord. He is the source of all potency. So it is him. So for him, it's just natural for him. But he's created this inferior show for the living entity to think that they are God. So this is the level that's here. And then one goes beyond that again, because that's only an intermediate step. Then goes one goes beyond it again and comes to the platform of spiritual rasa. Because this understanding of rasa is intellectual. It's the platform of, it's the rasa of liberation. But because Krishna is involved, it's actually beyond. But it's in between. Then you get to the transcendental. So this is the platform of vijnanamoy. Understanding we're the soul, we're not the body. There's a taste in there. And then one can bring it to the point of liberation and see these things happen. But because we're devotees, then we appreciate the actual transcendental rasa between the Lord and His devotees. That's the goal, not this in between. The jnana, the rasa, the jnana level is a tool to get out of the material world, to break our attachments to the material world and establish it in the real, in real rasa. It means the rasa of this world is not real, it's a perverted reflection. Like that. But, here it's spiritual, like that. So, therefore, he's the ocean of rasa. So all, whatever they're looking for, even that impersonal, is not the highest, because even that taste is coming from Krishna. So it can't be the highest. So he's mentioned that. And then he says, to attain Lord Krishna, I surrender to Sri Radha, and to attain Sri Radha, I surrender to Lord Krishna. By Radharani's grace, one can get Krishna, because if she is pleased with you, your service, then you can get Krishna. But you can only get Radha's service by Krishna's mercy. Because means to be able to surrender to devotees, to get that opportunity to associate with devotees, that is by Krishna's grace. He gives that opportunity. When you really want to surrender to Him, He puts you in contact with the devotees. Then the devotees bring you to Krishna. Like that. Because we know Krishna through the devotees. Like this. That's how we know Krishna. Otherwise, how do we know Krishna? We say we worship. Who do we worship? Which Krishna do we worship? There's one Krishna, but being the ocean of reservoir, or the ocean of rasa, which rasa are we approaching in? Because He's all of them. So how do we identify which Krishna we're worshipping? Which mood of Krishna we're worshipping? So they'll say, well, okay, we're worshipping Radha Krishna. And in the mood of the residents of Vrindavan. So that means we know Krishna through the devotees. Because Vraja means the devotees who are serving Krishna in that mood. Vaikuntha means those devotees who serve Krishna in that mood. Right? The Vaikunthavasis worship Krishna in awe and reverence. Therefore, it's called Vaikuntha. So if we want to go to Vaikuntha, we have to go to Vaikuntha through those devotees. Like that. So we understand? So by the grace of Krishna, one gets the devotees. And by the devotees, then you know Krishna in that particular way that you want to know. Otherwise, you won't know. We can't approach Krishna directly in Vrindavan. Otherwise, what's Vrindavan? We'll say, no, I just directly approach Krishna in Vrindavan. But then, what makes Krishna in Vrindavan? Right? If there's no Mother Yashoda, no Radharani, no Sudam and Sridam and Madhu Mangal, and no cows, you don't have Vrindavan. If nothing's there, you have Paramatma. If somebody's there, then you have that realm. So therefore, it's only through the devotees that we know Krishna. Therefore, this thing, to know Krishna, I surrender to the devotees. To know the devotees, I surrender to Krishna. By Krishna's grace, then we'll get the... If He's kind, then we can get the mercy of the devotees. Then we get the opportunity to contact the devotees. Yes?
He explained that you don't have to identify the activities and all these things. And I cannot even write that. I don't have conception that Krishna is a person. And when I try to not identify myself with some material things, I'm always ending with some kind of voidism.
Yeah, that's why karma yoga is first. Because karma yoga establishes the mind, the senses, the whole gross and subtle body in Krishna's service. And then from that, a taste will come, because it's devotional service. So being situated in that, then one can come to the other. But it's not as important. It means those who are into these kind of intellectual aspects, it's a useful tool for them. If one's not, if one is more emotional of these, one simply engages the emotions in the Lord's service. And then that will come, because one will just go from one to the one emotional platform to the other emotional platform. For me, it's from the material. From the sensual, we're trying to get ourselves to the mental. And then one can go from the mental, basically, to the transcendental. One doesn't have to go through the intellectual. But if the intellectual is one that does work in these things, then it must be engaged. Because whatever is the conditioned nature, it must be engaged. So one has to be able to understand that we're a person. So when we separate ourselves from this, it doesn't mean we're not a person anymore. The soul is a person. Soul has senses, has a mind, everything. But it's covered by this mundane one. So therefore, if we're not this body, it means we're a living entity. But we don't know we know we're servant of Krishna. Therefore, we will use this body in Krishna's service. Just like, let's say, you want to use a bicycle. You have to identify you are the bicycle to make the bicycle work. No. You simply have to know what is the nature of the bicycle to make it work. You don't know it's a bicycle, you think it's a pair of scissors, then it may not. You may have some difficulty in getting some efficient use out of the bicycle. So understanding we're not the body doesn't have to take on an impersonal concept at all. Just like riding a bicycle in a detached way doesn't have to take on any impersonal. Just we don't identify with the bicycle. Same way we don't identify with the body. We see, I have this body. It's like this. Okay, one, it's what species is it? Okay, it's within the human species. Within that, okay, then what is it? Then it's like this. Okay, it's male, it's female. It's of this age. It has this kind of maturity and experiences. Like this, it has this kind of interest or nature of efficient activities. These areas is very weakened, so... And so then we'll choose those areas that it's actually good at and then use those in Krishna's service. It's a tool. You want to cook something, you go into the kitchen, then depending upon what pots you have in the kitchen and what's in the refrigerator and that, then you'll cook something. Right? If you don't have the ingredients, you can't cook it. You can't say you're going to cook halva and all you have is cauliflowers. You know? Then you look at it, okay, I've got cauliflowers, so I can do something with cauliflowers. And then you look, you don't have any pots, you have an oven, you have a tray. Okay, so then we bake the cauliflowers. Or I have a pot, but it's flat-bottomed, then there's no ghee. Okay, then I'm going to have boiled cauliflower. You know, I have something that's round, I have some ghee, then I can make a sabji or deep-fry it, or like this. So depending on what you have, knowing the nature of it, an expert person then can do something. So we can see is that if one doesn't know the nature of what you have, then it won't be very efficient. Therefore we see socially, even amongst the devotees, the social system doesn't work because the devotees don't know what they have. Men don't know what a men's conditioned nature is. Women don't know what a woman's conditioned nature is. Neither know how the two match. So therefore they can't work it. Because you have to know the tool. If you don't know what a pot is and don't know what a cauliflower is and you're going to cook something, it's not going to end up very good. So thinking that you know is not enough. You actually have to know. Because it has a nature. The male and female nature, this, that, or a dog, or a house, it has its nature. We can't say, we can say this room, yes, we'll just fly from here to Calcutta in this room. We can say it all we want. We can write papers on it. We can get a PhD thesis on it. I can write and start a journal on it. I can become the world-recognized authority on this room is going to fly around. But it does not make one bit of difference. This room's going nowhere. It's a brick building sitting here on the second floor. So it has its nature. That's it. So what we think and what's the reality, that's the thing. Krishna created the place, not modern man. Right? When you go 5,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago was modern man. Right? So it's like modern man has nothing to do with reality. What things are, that's the reality. You know, it doesn't matter 5,000 years ago or today. You fall out of a 10-story building, you might get hurt when you hit the ground.
It is the same. You stick your hand in a fire, it'll burn. You stick it in water, it'll get wet. You know, you eat, you'll be nourished. You don't eat, you'll starve. Nothing's changed. The only thing that's changed is the modern person, because of their pride, won't accept authority. They think they're the center, they're God, what they think is real, and everything else is illusion. That's all that's changed. But the reality is the same. All it is the illusion has changed. But the reality, material world's real, and it has a nature. It's inferior material, and it has a nature. It works that way. It doesn't matter what anyone thinks. What makes the illusion is what we think of the material world. We think this is valuable. Like materialists will think, you know, gold is valuable, women are valuable, other possessions are valuable. That's the illusion. Like that. They're just material energy, a transformation. We make it valuable. You know, what fashion is in today, we make it valuable. You come after 5 years, you wear the same thing, they'll laugh at you. You know, or you wear it 5 years too early, they'll laugh at you. You have to wear it right when everybody's illusion is in tune with each other. And they all think this is nice. You know? So that's actually what's going on. So, because we don't understand the nature, therefore we can't make it work. The men can't be satisfied because they don't know what a man is. Women can't be satisfied, they don't know what a woman is. The men don't know what women are, women don't know what men are. So therefore, it doesn't work. It can't function. So you have to know what it is, and then use it as a tool. Okay, I have a man's body, or I have a woman's body, I have a child's body, I have an old person's body. Then what can that do for Krishna? You know, okay, so the 90-year-old man, he may decide not to be the runner for the GBC meetings. Because they can't do it, you know. So it would be an illusion to say, I'm going to do that. And then with great determination and, you know, all this, then they're going to overcome all obstacles. No, it would be foolish. They should pick something else to do for Krishna. You know, like sit and give out Charinamrita or something. You know, something that's, you know, nice. You sit in the temple, you get, you know, good association, hear the kirtan, and do some nice service. But it's like, you know, it's up to the, you know, it's up to speed with what you can do. Does that make some sense? So therefore, understanding we're not the body doesn't have to have anything to do with impersonal. It's just a matter of understanding this is the tool we have. This is the subtle and gross body that I have. So it does these things. That's all. We don't have to be attached. Well, I'd like to do that, but then you have the wrong form for it. The wrong, you know, I'd like to be, you know, like Bhima, I'd like to be able to, you know, run through the forest and knock down trees and, you know, like that. But we may not be able to do it. So it would be foolish to be attached to it. Attachment, therefore, is first is envy. We're envious of our service position as servant of Krishna. Next, we're attached to what we think we are and what we're going to get. So these two are given up. We accept I'm a servant and I'm not attached to the tools I use, the service that I do, and the results that I get from it. It's all for Krishna. Then one's transcendentally situated. It's that simple. But because we're conditioned, it takes a long time to wake up from the material dream. Therefore, the whole process is there, you know, to chip away at it slowly, slowly. So then over a lifetime, we wake up and then we understand, yes, you know, I use it. I do the duties of this world, but I'm not these things. Therefore, you know, just like the women aren't women, but the men aren't men. But that doesn't mean that they don't do their services. Prabhupada, you know, is not the body, but he acted as a man, as a sannyasi. He didn't go outside of that. That's the tools he had, so he used those. You know, similarly we see Draupadi, she's a pure devotee, but she acts like a woman, does all the duties of a woman. But she's not that body. You know, like this. So then, therefore, these things it's just seeing practically what tools you have and just doing some service. Because service is the point. So one has to see is we're persons, but we're not what we think we are. And Krishna's a person, he's not what we think he is. You know? Like that. He is transcendental. We're also transcendental. So we're not this body, but Krishna is a transcendental person. Does that make some sense? Jai.
Kunteya Moshai Kijai. Reading from Jaivadharma. I think we're in the 9th chapter on history of Vaishnavism. So this Nyaya Ratna is trying to establish that the Smarta religion is the real Vedic religion, and Vaishnavism is some new fandangled concept dreamt up by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. You know, so this is 100 years after Lord Chaitanya, this narration, this pastime. Nyaya Ratna is the name Krishna found in the Vedas, Vaishnava Das. Is not the word Shama a name of Lord Krishna? In the Rig Veda 122-164, it is said, "When I saw a cowherd boy, then I saw a cowherd boy who will never die." This is only one of many Vedic passages that describe Lord Krishna, the son of Agopa, Nyayaratna. These are all strained and twisted interpretations of the Vedic passages. This guy is never say die, right? Vaishnava Das. If one studies the Vedas thoroughly, he will see that these are the right interpretations. We should understand the Veda according to the explanations given by the ancient sages. Is that the mood of the sages? That has to be taken. That's very important. Then you understand what's the purpose. Just like the Vaishnavas can do that. Those who are not Vaishnavas may be led astray. Or even the neophyte Vaishnavas may be led astray because there's motive behind the activities. Just like, yeah. So he's pointing out here is one has to see what is their mood. Then the things make sense. Because he says they're selected, strained, like this. But then how do you say? But they're there in the text, in the passage. There will be so many verses on the demigods and on Shiva and this, because those will mostly be prayers. People are offering prayers. That's when you get all these different things that say they're the supreme, they're the controller, they're this, that. They're not coming in the pastime, really. They're coming in the prayer of the person in the pastime, is what we'll generally see. Someone will say so many things about Indra, like that. But otherwise, when they refer to Indra, they'll refer to him as the carrier of the thunderbolt, or, you know, one with a thousand eyes, or, you know, the king of heaven, or these kind of things. They don't call him supreme, this, that. They only do that when they're offering prayers. That time we'll see. So most people don't know the Vedas so well, so then they know these things. There's more volume of this. So then they'll say that they are strained from there. You've taken them and selected them, you know, very obscure. But here it's not. It's the, you know, just a proper flow of the pastime. So Nyaya Ratna. Now please narrate the history of the Vaishnava religion. This is what he wants to get around to. Vaishnava Das. I have already said that when the first individual soul came into existence, the Vaishnava religion came into existence with him. Therefore the demigod Brahma is the first Vaishnava. Lord Shiva is also a Vaishnava. The original Prajapatis are all Vaishnavas. Brahma's mind-born son Narada Goswami is also a Vaishnava. Can you not see that the Vaishnava religion was present at the moment the material universe was created? The truth is that not everyone is beyond the influence of the material modes. Whoever is genuinely free of the material modes is a genuine Vaishnava. The Mahabharata, Ramayana, and Puranas are all histories of the Vedic civilization. You have already seen that the Vaishnava religion was present at the moment the material universe was created. When the scriptures describe the different demigods, human beings and demons, there are descriptions of Prahlad, Dhruva, and other Vaishnavas from the very beginning. The Vedic histories have only recorded the names of some of the most famous. There is no saying how many hundreds of other great Vaishnavas there were at the time of Prahlad and Dhruva. Dhruva, Manu's sons, and Prahlad are all grandsons of Prajapati Kasyapa. Therefore, they lived at the very beginning of the universe. Of this there is no doubt. In the Vedic histories it is seen that the Vaishnava religion was present at the very beginning of time. The kings of the Chandravamsa and Suryavamsa, as well as the great Munis and Rishis, were all sincerely devoted to Lord Vishnu. These things are written in the descriptions of the three Yugas, Satya, Treta, and Dvapara. In the Kali Yuga, Sri Ramanuja, Sri Madhvacharya, and Sri Vishnuswami in the south, and Sri Nimbarkaswami in the west, brought many thousands to the pure Vaishnava religion. By their mercy, perhaps, half of the people of Varsha crossed the ocean of Maya and found shelter at the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. In Bengal, you may have seen Lord Satchinandana, who is the master of our hearts. How many fallen souls did he deliver? When you look at all these great souls, you do not see the glory of the Vaishnava religion. So here in history has to have, in the general history, it has to have five parts. It must explain about Krishna's creation, it has to explain about Brahma's creation, then it has to explain the histories of the Prajapatis, the Manus, and the Surya and the Sun and Moon dynasties as they come down. So here we see is through that, he has now explained and established the Vaishnava religion. Because Krishna's creation is there. As soon as one person is manifest, Lord Brahma, he's a devotee of Krishna. Then when he expands, then the Prajapatis, the other sages and Prajapatis, they're servants of Krishna. Then their praja, then the Manu and the great kings, they're also servants of Krishna. And that brings us down in the other ages. Then you come down, because the Surya and Vamsa, Surya and the Chandra dynasties, they finish 28 generations into the Kali Yuga. So then he takes it down through the Acharyas. That the Acharyas, then they have delivered so many people. Nimbarka, Vishnusami, Ramanuja, they have delivered so many. And now, then, just recently, then he is saying, then, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So we see historically, Vaishnavism has always been there. So it's from the beginning of the first person in the universe was a Vaishnava, and up to today you can see that they're a Vaishnava. So it's always been here. So that therefore, using the definition of history, he has then established Vaishnavism through this method. That's why it was used like this. Nyayaratna. Yes, but what kind of Vaishnavas are Prahlad and the others? What do you say? Vaishnava Das. One must study the scriptures thoroughly, rejecting the impersonal theory that Sanda and Amarka taught him. Prahlad instead made the holy names of Lord Hari the be-all and end-all of his life. Therefore, Prahlad was a pure devotee. Of this there is no doubt. The truth is that without careful and impartial investigation, one cannot understand the true meaning of the scriptures. So here, Sanda and Amarka, then they were... I think they're sons of Shukracharya, okay?
Yeah.
So they are smartest. So then he says, okay, they're Vaishnava. So he's asking, what kind of Vaishnava is he? So this is based on previously, because they're Vedic, they're smartest. So they would have taught him Vaishnava religion, but they would have taught him through the Upasana Kanda of Panchopasana. So they would have taught him how to worship Vishnu as the impersonal form that has manifested a form in goodness. It means the impersonal Brahman has come in the form of goodness, in the form of as Vishnu. And then you worship. And ultimately, that worship will free you, liberate you, and bring you to the impersonal platform. Therefore, he's made this point, is what kind of Vaishnava are they? So he says, yes, you've quoted their Vaishnavas. We agree fully, but what kind of Vaishnava? So he's saying he's a Panchopasaka Vaishnava. He's a Vedic Vaishnava. He's not actually this Vaishnava that Vaishnava Das is talking about. This one where they give up the Panchopasana worship and they worship the Lord, you know, in other means through the Pancharatra and through the Sattvika Tantras and like this. Therefore, he asked this question. Then he says, but they taught him, but he made the holy names his life and soul. So he didn't take up the Panchopasaka worship. And so therefore is that you have to impartially investigate. Then you'll see. If you go into it with your own idea, then you'll say, oh, see, Sanda Kumarka, they're his guru, so naturally he'll take the mood of his guru. Therefore, he's this kind of, you know, Vedic Vaishnava, which is previously described as not actually Vaishnavas at all, like that. Because Vaishnava means they accept the form of the Lord as eternal. So they don't accept the form of the Lord as eternal. So you can get them to take up the chanting and worship very nicely. They'll do it because they're already doing it. But to get them to come from the impersonal to the personal, then there's some work that's there. Therefore, you see, much of India, they're Vaishnavas. But they're this kind of Vaishnava, the Vedic. They're worshiping. Like you see Satyanarayan worship. Many times you have a picture of Satyanarayan is there
forearms, and they're all sitting there, you know, just regular human beings doing their puja, and there's a pujari there, and he's there with a big smile. That's the Panchopasana. That's not the eternal form of Vishnu. So therefore they're all mixed up, because all nowadays, all these persons who go around and do all these big Bhagavat Saptas and readings from Ramayana and all this, all the pastimes, everyone likes pastimes. But the idea is that you absorb yourself, and then you'll come to the liberated platform, and then you don't need these things. You'll come to the actual. Because you're a neophyte, therefore you need these histories, and you need the deity. But if you're actually advanced, you don't. That's their idea. So they're not really Vaishnavas. So sometimes we will say, you know, we'll invite them to do programs at our place, and that, saying that they're Vaishnavas. But according to the actual Vaishnava Siddhanta, they're not Vaishnavas at all. Just their impersonal approach is they use the techniques of Vaishnavism to get it. But their goal is not Vaishnava. So you have to see something that your relationships, your process, and your goal, that must be match. If your goal is impersonal, and your relationships are impersonal, and your process is personal, you can't say it's a personal process. You can't say they're actually personal. So one has to be able to distinguish. So that is Vaishnava Das's point here. Nyaya. Nyayaratna. If this is true, that the Vaishnava religion existed from time immemorial, then what new thing did Chaitanya Mahaprabhu teach that he should be especially honored? Vaishnava Das. The Vaishnava religion is like a lotus flower. It blossoms slowly. First it is a bud. Then it is partially blossomed. Only slowly does it become like a fully blossomed flower. At the time of the demigod Brahma, the impersonal theory, the practice of devotional service, and the knowledge of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as described in the four essential verses of the Srimad Bhagavatam, were new sprouts just beginning to grow in the hearts of the living entities. At the time of Prahlad and the others, the sprout had grown to become a bud. That you can see. At the time of Vyasamuni, that bud slowly opened, and at the time of the great Vaishnava Acharyas, it became a flower. When Srimad Mahaprabhu came to this world, that flower of love became fully blossomed and spread its sweet fragrance to everyone. Srimad Mahaprabhu revealed the most confidential secret of the Vaishnava religion, the pure love attained by chanting the Lord's holy names. In this way, he gave the greatest good fortune to the living entities in the material world. The chanting of the holy names of the Lord is such a valuable treasure. Who else but Lord Chaitanya revealed the truth of this? Although this truth was certainly described in the scriptures, it had not been revealed to the people in general. Ah, before Lord Chaitanya, had the treasure house of the nectar of love of God even been opened in this way? So the secret of this pure, because the fragrance comes when there's no material tinges, when there's nothing else. These other stages of means your karma yoga, your jnana yoga, your jnana yoga. These are all aspects of the devotional path. So all these were being shown in various ways. They were shown, and pure devotional service was also manifest. But we see with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, then this pure unalloyed devotional service that manifests. Therefore the sweetness, that fragrance that is there, was not seen before. It was not given before. Is that completely not desiring anything for oneself. Simply just what is Krishna's pleasure. That is what has been given. Therefore it's a natural blossoming of the whole Vaishnava. Truths. And so then Lord Chaitanya has revealed this. So this is what makes it special. All the others are bona fide, but they're just showing different stages. Therefore we see also in the Bhagavatam it goes through and describes all these devotees at these stages. And then till it finally comes to what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is given, or the affection of the residents of Braja for Krishna. So that is special, a pure unalloyed. Otherwise before that,
all so many other aspects have been already manifest. But this, revealing this, then had not been manifest. Right? We see that before, one can say, but no, Krishna performed his Vrindavan pastimes, so they were manifest. But we see that others, those who are worshippers in Vaikuntha, they appreciated them. But they became part of their sadhana within the rules and regulations. So Vaikuntha, they also appreciate greatly the pastimes of Krishna in Vrindavan. Of the 12 Alwars of the Ramanuja line, I think 3 of them wrote songs on Krishna's pastimes. So it's very much, one of them was completely dedicated to Krishna. Like that, Shri Prahlad, when he was in South, he met one of their pundits, and they were discussing, and he mentioned that actually Andal is an ISKCON devotee. Like that, she's one of the main, very prominent of the 12 Alwars. And says actually she's an ISKCON devotee, because everything she wrote is all about Krishna in Vrindavan. So she's like that. So it was there, but the pure unalloyed wasn't revealed. That pure devotional service was revealed. All the acharyas gave pure devotional service. You know, that serving favorably the Lord, without desire for karma or jnana. But pure unalloyed, there's still some mix of desire for liberation, and these other aspects were there. So then, there we see it's given. So in Vrindavan, in Vaikuntha, they appreciate the Vrindavan pastimes. Like that. You go to Tirupati, and he's only called Govinda. They're formally talking, they'll say Venkateshwar. But when they're offering prayer, they'll say Govinda. When they stand in the lines and they're coming and seeing the deity, they just say Govinda. And so we ask once, why you say Govinda? Because he's, Venkateshwar. He says, no, but of all of the pastimes that he performed, his favorite are the pastimes with the cows in Vrindavan. His Vrindavan Lila. Therefore, if you call him Govinda, then it reminds him of those pastimes. He's the most pleased, and therefore he'll get the most mercy. So they all just chant Govinda, 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 like this. And these are Vaikuntha worshippers, followers of Ramanuja. So therefore it's there. They appreciate, they chant them, they hear about them. Like you can go to Udupi, and many times they dress Krishna up as a gopi. Put him on a swing, he's sitting on a swing, dressed in a sari, or sometimes he's there with a big cow, big silver cow, playing a flute, and all kinds of, so all the Vrindavan pastimes are depicted. But it is part of Vaikunthapati's wonderful pastimes. Vaikunthapati came as incarnated as Krishna, performed all these pastimes. Therefore, it's a very nice thing. But he's God. God came and did all this. So only Lord Chaitanya revealed that, no, it's beyond this. Braj is beyond Vaikuntha. And there is pure unalloyed devotional service. There's nothing that we're trying to get for ourselves. That's what makes it then special. Therefore, as though it is a wonderful, it's a lotus, during the whole process, the sprout, then the bud, then the opening, then more open, and then Lord Chaitanya is fully open, and the fragrance is coming. Like when the flower becomes mature, then you get the fragrance. If you pick it early, it doesn't have the same fragrance. So the sweetness that has come with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Ah, now we get Nyayaratna. Well, if the chanting of the holy names is so sweet, why do the learned pandits not like it? Vaishnava Das. In the Kali Yuga, the word pandit no longer means what it once did. In the scriptures, the word pandit is defined as brilliant intelligence. Okay. And therefore, a person who has brilliant intelligence is called a pandit. Nowadays, anyone who can spout meaningless jargon from the Nyaya Shastra, and this guy's a Nyaya, right? Yeah. Or interpret the Smriti Shastra in a way to please the people in general is called a pandit. Are such pandits able to understand and or to teach the truth of religion and the true meaning of the scriptures? Can anyone attain through the meaningless jargon of the Nyaya Shastra the spiritual truth? which is to be attained by impartial and careful study of all the scriptures. In truth, only persons expert at cheating themselves and others are called pundits in the Kali Yuga. These so-called pundits may carry on great stormy debates over earthen pots and scraps of cloth. Yeah, because the pot is, the air in the pot is the pot the what do you call it? The support of what's in the pot, or is what's in the pot the support, right? Because you can say, of course, it's the pot. Without the pot, the other thing isn't in there. But the pot has no meaning with the stuff inside. So unless you have something that needs to be carried, you have to transport some milk, only for that reason the pot has come into existence. Therefore, then they sit there and argue with each other since time immemorial, which is the support, the pot of the milk. You know, like this. So that's what he's saying, these useless wranglings, meaningless jargon. What is reality? What is the relationship between the individual souls and the Supreme? What is the real spiritual need of all living entities? And how can that need be fulfilled? These pundits will never have a stormy debate to settle these things. So what he's explained here is the Sambandha Abhideya Prayojan. Reality. What is reality? In other words, what's the difference between spiritual and material? And within that, you know, what is the soul, what's the body, what's the Supreme Lord? What's the relationship between these? Then what's the spiritual need of all living entities? The need is your goal, your prayojan. What you need is what you endeavor for. And how can that need be fulfilled? You need a process. So that's the Abhideya. That's the process of devotional service. So your need is love of God. Your process is the devotional process. And the relationship is we are servants of the Lord. So he's saying that pundits will never have a debate to settle these things, because they don't want a conclusion. See, the intelligence, if you want, sense gratification means it should have no conclusion. Right? Because intellectualness has its taste because there is no conclusion. That's why in the academic world, it is a number one no-no to say this is the truth. Like that. It's all right to say, this is my theory. And this is how it works. And not only you can look at it critically, everybody can look at it critically. And they all can sit there and appreciate it, pick it apart. It's just something to appreciate. And then they all look at it and say, this is nice or this is weak here. And if it's better than what they have, then they'll appreciate it more. If it's less, then they'll poke holes in it. And in this way, then they just go on. If you say, no, this is it, absolutely it is taboo. It is absolutely not allowed. You can't do it. Because then the whole process of academia stops. Right? Then it becomes a matter of truth is there, now we have to understand it. Right? This is in the Vedas, because there's the Shastra, therefore you don't have this problem. The problem is what's the conclusion. Right? The West, it's a problem of what is the standard. This goes back to this time of Plato. It goes back before, but Plato is in modern history, Socrates. In modern history, where you can say this problem has come up. Socrates says there's an absolute truth, and we have to know that truth and adjust ourselves with that truth. The sophists say, no. The people, they make up the truth. What they say is true is truth. What the mass says, that's truth. And what the others... what the mass says, that's truth, and what the minority says is not truth. Of course, if you can politic enough and get your minority to the majority, then it becomes truth. So this is there. So Western academic follows that line. So therefore, nothing's sacred. No scripture is sacred. No thought is sacred. Nothing's sacred. You know, because the purpose is simply to exploit and enjoy the intellectual pleasures of, you know, mental speculation. While the Vedic is they accept the authority of the scriptures, but they still don't want to come to a conclusion because they want to enjoy that speculation. So that's their sense gratification, their intellectual sense gratification. So Nyaya then is the medium of that sense gratification, because through that then logically you establish. Because Nyaya means is you have a technique how to defeat someone else. It doesn't mean that what you're saying is right. You know, like modern lawyers, is that you can go in, you know that your client is guilty, You know that the other person is saying truth, but you go in there and by your techniques of, you know, your, whatever it is, dealing with the law, your logic, then you defeat the other person and establish your client as innocent. Like that. So it's simply a technique of discussion and how your discussion can be more successful than their discussion. Your point can be established over their point. Therefore, they take great, great pleasure in the fight and in controlling. And so then this way then they become the controllers and enjoyers. They fight with words. The Kshatriyas will fight with swords and their politics like this. So they will fight using Nyaya. That's their politics. So that's why he says that, he makes the point is that in an impartial way you have to go, because Nyaya means it's already partial. You have your point, you want to establish it, bus. Like that. Only when one understands the truth of these things, in other words, the sambandhi, the relationship process and goal, will one be able to know the answer to the question, what is the value of the loving chanting of Lord Hari's holy names? So because they're only interested in all these debates, they'll never be able to understand. They won't get the taste, because the taste is in arguing. Because conclusion is there. You just take it, chant it, do it. It's already there. The mango's there, it's already been. There is no skin, there is no seed, just eat it. But then they want to argue over, but how we should eat it. Or is this a real mango, or is this an illusion mango? Or should I be eating it? Should someone else be eating it? Like this. Nyaya Ratna. Well, I'll certainly agree that there are hardly any good pundits nowadays. Still, why is it that the great brahmanas born in exalted families refuse to accept your Vaishnava religion? The brahmana caste is in the mode of goodness. Brahmanas are naturally on the right path and naturally attracted to the highest religious principles. Why then are the brahmins so ferociously opposed to the Vaishnava religion? Yeah, here is means that this time your caste Brahmins, they would follow all their, you know, their little rituals very, very nicely, at least according to their understanding. Like that. So he's saying is that they're in goodness, their path is in goodness, they're attracted to the path of goodness. You know, so why do they so much dislike if this is the best? Vaishnava Das. Since you have asked this question, it is right that I give the proper reply. Means, other words, he would have avoided saying anything denigrating the Brahmins in this regard. Just like before, he wouldn't have said anything about the pundits, but because he brought it up, why the pundits don't like? Well, actually, are they pundits? So now he's brought up the Vaishnavas. Now he will say this. It is right that I give the proper reply. Still, Vaishnavas do not like to criticize others. Look, if you will not feel pain and anger in your heart, and if you desire to know what is the real truth, I can answer your question. Nyaya Ratna, do it. I have studied the scriptures. I am in favor of peacefulness, self-control, and tolerance. Your words will not be intolerable for me. Please speak straight. I accept what is good and true. Vaishnava Das, look, Sri Ramanuja, Madhva, Vishnuswami, and Nimbarka were all brahmanas. They had thousands and thousands of Brahmana disciples. Yeah, Ramanuja, he was a very high Brahmin family. Because there was a time that his guru, I think, I'm sure it was maybe Gostipurna. His guru was also Brahmin, but not in as high a Brahmin level. Because even within Brahmins, there's levels. And so then one day, Ramanuja's wife and his guru's wife were at the well. And they were pulling up. It was a big well, so they were both pulling up buckets of water. And in pulling and talking and all that, the bucket that the guru's wife was having got higher than the one that Ramanuja's wife. And when you're pulling up a bucket, it shakes and that, and it's full, very full, because you drop it inside the water. And when you pull it up, it's completely full to the brim, and it's dropping water all the way down. So as it was doing this, some of the water from the guru's wife's bucket fell into the one of Ramanuja's wife's bucket. So she immediately dropped her bucket back in the well because it was considered unclean. You know, she waited till the guru's wife had pulled her bucket out, then she raised her bucket again. So when Ramanuja found out about this, then he was very disturbed. So we can see that he was from a very high Brahmin family, not even just the Brahmin family, but the top Brahmin families. They had thousands and thousands of Brahmin disciples. In our Bengal, our Mahaprabhu was a Vaidika Brahmana. Our Nityananda Prabhu was a Radhiya Brahmana. Our Advaita Prabhu was a Rajendra Brahmana. Our Goswamis and Mahantas were mostly Brahmanas. There's Rupa Goswami, there's also Rupa Sanatana, their family, they are Gaur Saraswat Brahmanas. And in that, they're from Bharadvaj Gotra, which is, I think, considered amongst them the highest. I can't say for sure. But it is very top. It means of Brahmanas, the Saraswat Brahmanas are the best. Of those, some say the Gaur Saraswat are better. And within that, then those are Bharadvaj line, those are considered even top amongst them. And so Rupa and Sanatana, they're from this line. Raghunath Bhatta and Gopal Bhatta, then Gopal Bhatta, his father, they were the head pujaris at Sri Rangam, so they were top Vaishnava families. You know, his uncle, means his father's brother, was Prabodhananda Saraswati. Right, this, like the Raghunath Bhatta Bhatta is a Brahmin, is top Brahmin name. Like this. So many were of very high level. Thousands and thousands of great souls who were the tilak markings of great Brahmana families. These tilak markings means just like the top, you know, the ornament on the head. It means you take the Brahmana families and then the head is the best, and on that then the tilak. Tilak means ornament. They took shelter of the Vaishnava religion and preached the pure Vaishnava religion to the people of the world. How can you say that exalted Brahmanas do not honor the Vaishnava religion? This we know. All the Brahmanas who honor the Vaishnava religion are all exalted Brahmanas. Only because of bad families, bad association, or bad education do some Brahmanas become enemies because their Brahminical principles are so great and exalted. Yes, this may be a pun. They become enemies because they are degraded and unfortunate. The scriptures declare that in Kali Yuga the number of true Brahmanas is very few. These few Brahmanas became Vaishnavas. Means in the Kali Yuga, then actual Brahmanas are very few. I mean, so many Brahmin families are there. Very few of them are actually real Brahmanas. Those Brahmanas already became Vaishnavas. So the ones that aren't really Brahmanas, they're the ones that are the enemies of the Vaishnavas. Because they're from bad families, they've had bad association, bad education. Like that. They are degraded, they are unfortunate, so they're not really Brahmanas. Therefore, they are in this position. When he accepts the Vaishnava Gayatri, which is the mother of all the Vedas, a Brahmana becomes an initiated Vaishnava. However, pushed by the faults of Kali Yuga, such a Brahmana may then accept another, a non-Vedic initiation. In this way, he loses his status as a Vaishnava. Simply because you see they are few in number, please do not come to the wrong conclusion about the Vaishnava Brahmanas. Because the mother of the Vedas, she is a devotee of the Lord. She is known as Vagisha. She is the Lord is known as Vagisha, or the Lord of Saraswati. So then Gayatri Devi, then she is a devotee of the Lord. And she then, by accepting her, then one takes up the service to the Lord. But he says here, they accept other non-Vedic initiations, means tantra, means this person's a tantric, he's a Devi worshipper. So that's another initiation that he's talking about. Then they become non-Vaishnavas. But otherwise, with the Vaishnava, the Upanayanam, they actually become devotees. But here, some of them, the smartas, they accept other initiations, then they lose their Vaishnava status. Thank you. Yeah, you're right. No. Why do many low-class people embrace the Vaishnava religion, Vaishnava Das? There is no doubt of that. Many low-class people are naturally very humble, and for this reason the Vaishnavas consider them good candidates for their mercy. No one can become a Vaishnava without first receiving the mercy of the Vaishnavas. Persons who are intoxicated with pride of caste, pride of wealth, or other kinds of pride cannot be humble. For them, it is very difficult to attain the mercy of the Vaishnavas. Are there any other questions on this? Yes.
You mentioned why one becomes a devotee.
Means one becomes Vaishnava, because then from that one is supposed to perform all the Vedic rituals and that, and it's actually Vishnu is the goal of all of them. So then means they worship Shaligram, and if, even if they're doing worship of the demigods, they have to worship Shaligram first. So with that, then they're technically they would be Vaishnavas, though if they understand that, then they actually are. But if not, then they're not. But here, he is making this point because this Nyayaratna has not accepted. He's a Brahmin. He's accepted Upanayana, but now he's also then accepted mantras because he's a Devi worshipper. Like that. That is in the beginning of the chapter. Then his whole history was described. I mean, someone else who was considered a Vaishnav, then he became bewildered hearing so many different differences between these Panchopasaka Vaishnavas and the Gaudiya Vaishnavas. So then he goes to this Nyayaratna, who is very well learned in that, and then asks him what's going on. And then he says that actually these Gaudiyas are not true Vaishnavas, that the Panchopashaka Vaishnavas are proper. So then they make an arrangement to come and speak to the Nyayaratna. They dress as just regular persons, and then come. And so then they come to ask questions, and then Vaishnava Das is brought. Vaishnava Das, he himself before was a good Brahmin family. He took sannyas, he studied in Varanasi the Vedanta Sutra, and so he knows all the Shankarite conclusions, and he was like bordering on liberation. So then, because of that, then Krishna arranged that he met the Vaishnavas. He became attracted. He came to Vrindavan, to Mayapur, to Godrum. He associated with the devotees. He himself then became an advanced Vaishnava. So then whenever it gets into technical Vedic kind of things, arguments, then generally he's the one that's brought to discuss with them because he knows the field. So he already discussed with the local Navadvipa pundits and defeated them over this point of how can low-class people embrace Vaishnavism. And then now with this Nyaya-Ratna. Okay. Anything else? Yes.
Maharaji, you were saying that everything is Krishna, the taste, because he is the source of all matter, his rasa. So the taste that we find in things and what we like is Krishna. But still, devotees are not supposed to enjoy Krishna in the sense of enjoying him for themselves. Rather in the middle, so that they should enjoy as much as they can serve. Still, we see that in the spiritual world, everybody is mad in love with Krishna. And so, how do we conciliate this selflessness and at the same time this total dedication and absorption through the senses, transcendental senses? And
because they're serving Krishna through the senses. And so because Krishna is happy, they're happy. It's favorable. See, it's like, okay, so mother is enjoying the sweetness of the interactions of the attachments between mother and child. That's actually Krishna. Because Krishna is the mother and Krishna is the child. The soul is just the observer standing on the side. But because they identify that they're either the child or the mother, therefore, they feel that they are the enjoyer. They are enjoying it. But actually, it's Krishna is the form of the child. He's the mentality. He's everything. How the child acts, because all children act the same, that's Krishna. It's his potency. And mothers, they all act the same and interact the same, and that's Krishna. So what's happening is Krishna is relating with Krishna. Krishna in potency of mothers relating with Krishna's potency as child. But because we identify with one of them, then we then take that enjoyment for ourselves. We think, I'm doing this, I am taking care of my child, or I am, you know, interacting with my mother, so therefore the result is also mine. So we take that as our own and try to enjoy that. But it's not favorable, because it's not for Krishna's pleasure, it's for our pleasure. The mother and child are engaged in those activities for their own personal pleasure. So then the first step is then how to dovetail that in Krishna's service, because if that emotional need is there, it's not going to go away too quickly. Therefore, then one looks at it, okay, since it is Krishna, then how does Krishna want those activities to be done? How does Krishna want a mother to deal with a child, or a child with a mother? Following those rules, then that interaction becomes favorable for Krishna. Though we may have an attachment for it. But then it becomes Sakam Karma Yoga instead of just karma. Then if we go to the next stage, because this is how Krishna wants it, that's my duty to do it that way. You know, I have these attachments, so I should engage in these servant activities, but not for myself, to please Krishna. I should just, it's a realm of my attachment, so I should just use that attachment for Krishna. But I'm not trying to get the results of that. So then one will engage in that way, and that will bring one to the next platform, Nishkam Karma Yoga. Then the residents of Vrindavan, that is their particular way that they love Krishna, because they are not dealing with an external body, they're dealing directly with Krishna. They're not dealing with Krishna having come through the material energy and empowered the body of a child as a son. They're dealing directly with Krishna. So their love for Krishna is then transcendental. And so the form of it is transcendental. And they're doing it to please Him. They love Him. They want to see Him pleased. Because He's pleased, they become happy. Because in a selfless relationship, the other person's pleasure, that is the happiness, not something else. Otherwise, it's mixed. You want them happy, you want to be happy. It's mixed. You just want them happy, then that's considered pure. Like that. So then all it is it's just, it keeps going. They're fully realized. They know who they are as servant of Krishna, and they know who Krishna is. And they know their relationship with Krishna. Therefore, it takes on a different flavor than here. You know? So here it's the exact opposite. We think we are the enjoyer. We think we're Krishna. So therefore the activities we do, the enjoyments we get, are coming from us, the results are ours, and so we enjoy. Then the next stage is to bring it into Karma Yoga, Nishkam Karma Yoga. Then take it beyond into the transcendental. So that's the process. That's the yoga ladder that Krishna talks about in the Gita. Does that make some sense? It means if it doesn't make too much sense, don't worry about it. You know, it's one of those. It's just that's how it works. But it's okay. Because there's not so much time. We can discuss it more tomorrow, because we should end now. Because other programs are there. We should. Okay. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki, Srila Vita Bhaktivedanta ki, Srila Nitya Gaura Premanand. Hare Hare.